This particular week has not been a week full of laughs after the mass murder in Las Vegas, but humor will return. It always does. And our first guest this hour says that's a really important part of being human. Al Jeaney takes a risk and writes about what makes things funny and the importance of being funny, why we need more jokes in our lives. Al Jeaney teaches business ethics at Loyola University, Chicago. He's no stranger to radio, having spent several years as the radio philosopher on a public station in Chicago. He still gets regular airtime on a commercial station in the city. Al Jeaney, thanks for joining us.
A pleasure to be with you.
I wonder if writing a book about comedy is sort of like the warnings to actors about working with kids and pets that you...
Oh, great question. You know what? My wife was going nuts. In my office, I would close my door. I have this wonderful library at home, and I would write only at home. And when she would be home, she said, "Who are you talking to down there? Why are you laughing? What are you doing down there? This is research?" No, it was a joy. It really was a joy. I've written a number of books, much more turgid and too serious for this, but to study humor, there's always a danger when you study something, you ruin its magic. And in studying humor, I realized, no, it is magic. What you got down to the core is, this is magic. And there's no way to absolutely define it or pickle it or bottle it. And so I described it as such and then laughed along with it.
Was it time to write about humor after writing books about business ethics and things like that?
Well, I haven't just written about business ethics, which is, the classic oxymoron kind of thing.
Military intelligence?
Military intelligence, jumbo shrimp, penis dentistry. Or how about this one? Equitable divorce settlement. That's my favorite one. But pleasant teenager. Have you heard that one? I've been doing it for a couple of years, so you can't outwit me on that one. But no, I looked at business ethics, and I looked at humor as a way. Ethics to me, and I apply it to humor, is a way of making life more convivial. Is a virtue that I want to develop with people so that they could trust me, that I'm an ethical person. They could trust me. You could depend on me. If I give my word, I'm really going to make my word. And as a person who honors humor at the right time in the right place, that I'm a good fellow, that I want to reach out to you, that I'm offering you a gift, that I use humor not as an escape, but a way not to die of the truth. To use a Woody Allen phrase, I tell jokes in self-defense against reality. But not only jokes. I think seriousness and silliness are requirements of life. And I think the true comic knows the balance between.
Some of this comes from your Uncle Joe, as you point out in the book. Tell us about him and his approach.
Oh, thank you for asking me that question. I started writing this book 73 years ago.
When you were 1 year old.
When I was, two. So now you know my age. Wait a minute, 73. Yeah, that's okay. Anyway, I had this wonderful Uncle Joe in my life. I hope everyone has had an Uncle Joe or an Aunt Mary in their life, depending on your gender, that was the dependable adult who loved you and gave you good advice and helped you and didn't judge you and smacked you across the chops when you needed it as well. But you could go to them and you always knew you were going to have a fair hearing rather than the parent losing it, et cetera, et cetera. And Uncle Joe, until the week before he died, every time he saw me in the embrazo, he would grab me and just before the kiss, he would say, "Did you hear the one about?" And he told me a joke. And they were always, and rarely did he repeat himself. And the jokes, I must tell you, got a little naughtier as I went along because he was no prude, et cetera, et cetera. And they were very satirical and so on and so forth. Somewhere in my teenage years, in Act of Rebellion, I said, "Uncle Joe," it was better in Italian, "Che cosa fai? What are you doing? Why are you telling me these jokes? Leave me alone. I'm cool." He said, "Why are you telling me jokes? Why?" And he looked at me and said, "Alfredo, if I didn't love you, why would I want to make you laugh? If I didn't care about you, why would I give you the gift of humor? And it's a weapon too, sweetheart. Use it carefully. It's a sword and a shield, and you'll need it as you go along." And I've never forgotten that. And I've tried to duplicate that with my family, sometimes excessively, just as my family.
Right.
But I've tried to perpetuate that with friends and students as well.
So we need humor. That is a major theme of the book. We need humor, good times and bad. And obviously don't bring it in too soon in bad times. And there's a great history lesson here from Abraham Lincoln himself, who presided over one of the worst periods in American history.
Yeah, and he needed to laugh. He said, "I need to tell jokes the way that a tradesman needs a good shot of bourbon, a good shot of whiskey to perk him up. And he didn't drink, by the way. He did drink on occasion, but he didn't drink because everybody drank in those days. And he said, I got to stay sane as a young man, and that was a way to stay focused. But he needed humor, and he told stories. And if you saw the wonderful film Lincoln, based on Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, he even told stories in the middle of a catastrophe to the point that some of his staff would say, enough, I don't want to hear about this anymore. And he looked at Stanton one, and he says, without these jokes, I would die from the misery of this pain. You must allow me to tell these jokes. And whether he knew it or not, he was anticipating Mel Brooks, who was my uncle's favorite comic and maybe mine. And by the way, I saw him perform twice in the last 18 months when he was 89 and 90. And he performed for an hour and a half. They had to drag him off stage. The more we laughed, the more exuberant he became, the more animated he became, singing, dancing, telling jokes from everywhere. And they had to drag him off. And at one point, when he'd literally been dragged off by his handlers, right? He said he looked up at the Great Chicago Theater, one of those marquee theaters from the Depression, you know, beautifully sculptured and wonderful curtains and all that. He says, this is why I made films. So people would come together in this beautiful palace, this beautiful temple, and laugh together. It's our only salvation. Thank you, Chicago. It was a mystical experience for me.
Let me throw it back to Abraham Lincoln again, because there's a joke in here that people told about Lincoln at the time, apparently. Two Quakers are talking about Lincoln, Jefferson, Davis.
Not only did he like telling jokes, he loved jokes, and he read satirists all the time. In fact, sadly, the night he was shot, he had four columns of political satirists in his pocket that he had been reading that day. But he loved this joke about him. And two Quaker ladies, I hope I do it justice, are walking down the street and during the Civil War, and one says to the other, whom do you think will win this war? And the one woman says, I think Mr. Jefferson of the Confederacy will win. Really, she says, I think Mr. Lincoln of the North will win. Why do you think Mr. Jefferson won? Because he's a godly man and he prays. And the other woman says, well, Mr. Lincoln is a godly man and he prays. And the other woman looks at her and says, yes, but I don't think God actually believes him. And that he's only joking, right? And that's the final line. That he believes him, and he's only joking. And Lincoln loved that because this dour, serious man. By the way, he was laughing all the time. The pictures we see of Lincoln are because of the Durer types, if I'm saying the word correctly, where it took 1 to 3.5 minutes to take the photo.
Oh, yeah, you couldn't smile because
so
your cheeks would...
So you couldn't smile for 3 minutes, right? So you had to be somber. But he used those photos. He was really a technocrat. He used photos as a way to communicate what he looked like to others, and that was important for him. He had portraits done the day, I think, he passed the bar. He rented a suit and had his hair slicked back and took a picture. It's a horrible picture. But, you know, he understood the need to be a human being to others and not just a name.
Which is what this book is about, The Importance of Being Funny. Al Jeaney's our guest, the author of the book. We'll go back from Abraham Lincoln to Abraham and Sarah. Yes, we'll go that far back to what it may be history's first joke when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Al Jeaney and your phone calls and emails. Got a joke you want to share? Bring that in as well. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest is Al Jeaney, who is a business ethics professor at Loyola University Chicago. He's a radio personality on both public and commercial radio there as well. The author of several books. You can tell from one of his previous titles, The Importance of Being Lazy. He's got a sense of humor. His latest book is called The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. It's yes, there are jokes in it, but it's also about why we need humor so much at this and any time in history, really. Join us on the Exchange. Maybe you have a joke to share. 800-838-3760. Yes, it needs to clear the button test. 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. So there is a brief history of humor in the book. And I should point out the book itself, obviously, is a book about humor, and it's not going to be terribly thick or heavy. So it is a light history of humor. How far back are we sure there was humor, Al? And how do we know?
Well, as my Jewish side of the family would say, well, it went back a long time, what can I tell you? You know, I can't hardly remember, it's so long ago. Wait, let me think. The Egyptians, supposedly 2,900 years B.C. or B.C.E., however the correct political correct term is, had a hieroglyph for laughter and comedy. And then in Genesis, we have this interesting combination of Abraham, Sarah, and Isaac. And it's an interesting story because Abraham and Sarah are long in the tooth by this point, right? And so one night, a group of angels show up at the tent for dinner. It happens all the time, I'm sure, in your neighborhood too. So one of the angels turns out to be God. Didn't know, looked like the rest of the angels, but, you know, and he says that Sarah is with child. And Sarah begins to laugh. Just, well, you got to be kidding. I'm long past that time. We don't do that stuff no more. What are you laughing at me? And so then this angel really reveals himself as God and says, do you mock God? I'm God. And she says, no, God, no. If you say I'm pregnant, I'm pregnant. Okay. She says, don't mock me. That's inappropriate. So, boom, boom. And he goes off. And she is pregnant. And she has Isaac. And Isaac is derived from the Hebrew phrase for laughter. Interesting, right?
Isn't it?
At the age of 90 plus, they had a child. Some scholars say that's the first sex joke, because it's a joke on them. God, what a funny guy! And there you go, to be pregnant at 90. I, in my life, remarried somewhere down the line and almost had a child in my 60s, and it didn't seem funny to me at all, but that's another story.
I wondered about the your knowledge of the phrase equitable divorce. It sounded like a first-person story. This is great. It sounds like then in the discussion between God and Sarah that God was actually the first one to get a laugh.
Yeah, first one to get a laugh or to force a laugh out of that, you know, and because he's kind of smirking. So you don't think I'm funny?
Right. So, let's stay with the historians. I mean, are there ancient civilizations that were regarded as especially jokey or something? I mean, is there like a whole civilization of banana peel people or something?
Well, I think historians will tell you there are a number of nations that were a joke, but I've heard the banana peel people. But, you know, it goes all the way back to the Romans. There's a collection of Philolobus, I'm mispronouncing it right now, forgive me. I can't do my Latin after my Jewish accent. A collection of jokes and stories, and we've got one of them, you know, the gentleman comes in for a haircut, and the... and the barber says, how would you like your hair done? He says, in silence, please, you know. And so these early jokes are there. And then there was a whole collection of jokes in the Middle Ages of great sex jokes for priests and jokes about bribery and jokes about government, so on and so forth. So collecting jokes has been part of who we are. It goes all the way back to even in Alexander the Great's father, there were jokes in ancient Greece. So I think... lots of traditions, and the better way to establish humor is in studying. I found a wonderful book called Fools Are Everywhere by Beatrice Otto. It's a study of not clowns, but a study of jesters. And she argues that jesters were pandemic across any major culture, and even in smaller cultures. For example, American Cheyenne, indigenous peoples, they're the contrarians. They were able to say anything because they were contrary, and they were listened to because they were wise.
That's really interesting, the idea that they could tell the truth in ways that other people couldn't, but it had to be funny.
And they were institutionalized. Now, they had to be in their outfits, you know. They weren't always, you know, yellow and with hats and all that. They had to be playing their role. But they could say things that either Socrates or Seneca could say to power, right? They could be the satirist to power, but they were in the role. But they had to do it in a comical event, right? But these persons became very, very important in courtly life and very often became ministers and counselors to the king. And if nothing else, relieved the king or the queen's tedium. Now, most of them were kings and most of the jesters were men, not women.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, even in Shakespeare's time, there was no women on stage. Played every role. They could speak truth to power, but always carefully, just as in, you know, think about this, the presidential, the reporter's dinner, where Obama made that an art form. And his last one, you know, God, we should play that every night. You want just great laughs? Play that one again. But Mr. Trump didn't go to this, his first one. But even there, where everyone was supposed to be able to tell jokes, you had to be very careful of the jokes you told. You remember Mr. Bush not being pleased a number of times.
Yeah.
So on and so forth. And, you know, sometimes comics go too far. I mean, I love comedy, and we go to a lot of comedy clubs. My wife says, again, we got to go to a comedy club. I said, shut up. It's a write-off. Let's go.
It's research.
But a boom. But it is. in a sense. But, you know, some of it's pure scatology. I'm going, oh, the F word, every third word. That's great. Got any, you know, got anything going for you? So I think comedy is, you have to be very careful. I think we give great license even now to comics. And certainly the example of that is this wonderful cadre of comedians led by Jon Stewart and his whole tree. You know, John mm-hmm. Oliver, Samantha Bee, Stephen Courbet, so on and so forth. And Bill Maher, who's really the grandfather of it all. He's been doing this for 20 years now, insulting people up there. And so you've got this whole cadre of people and also Saturday Night Live people whom I primarily see as cultural satirists and only occasional political satirists.
Right, when they got heavy into the political satires, when they really they cleaned up in the Emmys this year.
Well, they did this year, but you got to remember, Alex Baldwin is just doing a spot-on impression. There's nobody better than Baldwin doing that right now, okay? But in fact, since day one, you're too young for this, aren't you?
No.
Since day, yes, you are.
No. I remember the first
All
second
right,
season
then
of Saturday
you remember
Live,
anyway. It was Chevy Chase doing Jerry Ford.
Right, falling downstairs, yeah.
And then it was Dan Aykroyd doing Jimmy Carter. Inflation too high, no problem. Print more 20s. You know, and so there's been a comic to make fun of the president along the way. But they're mainly cultural. But since Trump, and without saying casting aspersions against Trump, because we're having an academic, discipline, objective conversation, the real case is that he's just a lightning rod for satire and comedic observation. You know, his hair, his demeanor, his persona, his language. And Saturday Night Live has gone to town on it. But think about this. All five of the major nighttime shows, they don't do a little political comedy. It's all political comedy. And before, Johnny Carson and Leno and Letterman, they told political jokes, but they were one-offs. Where, you know, Stephen Courbet, the whole show is
very heavy on
yeah.
Trump. We're talking to Al Jeaney from Chicago about his book, The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. Your thoughts on humor and even your jokes are welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Stephen in Yreka, welcome to The Exchange. What do you got? Hello, Stephen.
I'm here.
Go ahead.
Why does Buckley wash his clothes in Tide?
Why does Buckley wash his clothes in Tide?
Yeah.
Why?
It's too cold out Tide.
Oh, it's too cold outside.
Oh, ba-da-boom.
Truly. Okay, thanks for that, Stephen. Appreciate it. You were just talking about Jon Stewart, and I wanted to come back to a particular
yeah.
point that I will never forget him saying, which is he said that the trick was to realize the things that made them angry that day and write the show about that, and then later in the day pull the anger out.
Right. Also, let's be very clear. These shows are not fake news shows. This is real news that they're making fun of, right? So it's fake analysis, but they're making fun of. And I think you have to do that. Otherwise, it goes into vitriol, if I'm using that word correctly. I think you have to, you know, put a little twinge to it. It's like telling a marriage joke, you know. You want to tell a marriage joke to kind of illuminate something funny or even to make a point, but you can't be vicious about it, then it's over, right? Or an overly graphic sex joke. I think Amy Schumer, for example, is a brilliant woman.
Mm-hmm.
I think her delivery is spot on. Nobody does it better. That little coquettish, delicious, blonde, white woman up there, you know, who's pretending to be naughty. And she's a great writer if you've seen her first film and some of her
yes,
comedy specials. But I want to tell you, in person, I know too much about her body, just way, way too much about her entire sexual experience, and I've had enough, right? And I don't want to go anymore. I think she's smarter than that. She's funnier than that. She should do something more than that. So I think that I want to go back to Jon Stewart right there. Jon Stewart, you know, I think created an empire out of saying, you can't be too specific. You've got to take the anger out of you. You really got to look for the golden nugget there. What's the real issue here? Is this show up the absurdity? There's where lies the fun, and the stupidity, not that. And here's, we're talking about marriage jokes or sex jokes. Here's my favorite. I have two favorite sex jokes, and this is my first one. And if you really beg me later, I'll tell you my favorite sex joke, and I promise you'll still be on the air tomorrow. well, I don't promise. Probably. I don't know. Maybe. Anyway. But my favorite one is Jerry Seinfeld, marriage joke. And Jerry Seinfeld says, just looks at the crowd and says, you know, I didn't realize my voice had a tone. That is until I got married. Right?
Yeah, right.
Right.
Your voice is grating. Yeah, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that kind of thing. It's not degrading. It's just, you know, it's a reflection. People live together a long time, you know, da-da-da-da. You're not, as my wife always says, oh, we're out someplace. Oh, I've read your books. Oh, I love your work. Oh, I love listening to you on radio. Yeah, and then my wife looks at him and says, yeah, but you don't live with them. Ba-boom. Right.
You were just talking about Amy Schumer, though, and you know more about her body than you want to do. I had the same experience with watching Ali Wong, because she was talking about those sexual practices she likes, and I was like, okay, so that's fun. But the thing that gets Louis C.K., of all people, can go into places where I don't think a comedian has ever dared to go before. He was doing a monologue on Saturday Night Live one time when he hosted about child molestation.
Yes.
Do you remember that? And he got away with it. He made it funny somehow. It was odd.
I know, and I can't explain that. Next question. No, I really can't explain that, because that, for me, is a bridge too far.
Mm-hmm.
That, for me, is analogous to, let's tell funny 911 jokes.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah, right, exactly.
Let's tell, you know, are there going to be any jokes about Reno? I hope not.
About Las Vegas, yeah, not anytime soon. That's
I'm
for
sorry.
Sure.
Did I say Reno? Forgive
yeah.
me.
Las Vegas. Let's take a call in here. We have Connie and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Al Jeanie, the author of The Importance of Being Funny.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
I just have a question, a simple one, really. I know there's probably lots of articles in various psychology journals about the psychology of humor, but, you know, it's always astonished me as sort of being an omniscient observer when I'm in a humorous theater situation, a film or live theater, who laughs and where?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it just seems really difficult to pinpoint. I can't imagine being a comedy writer to determine, you know, each person brings something unique into the theater.
Right.
And then even within a day or a week or a year, what you laugh at one time, you don't laugh at another.
Absolutely.
So the uniqueness of each person's response to humor would be something that would be really difficult to write for.
Yes, and the situation, too. Thanks for that, Connie.
That's why being a stand-up comic is maybe the hardest thing imaginable. There was just an HBO special, I'm Dying Up Here, which I didn't particularly like. It was too dark and dreary. But they were right. You're up there night after night trying to perfect the same routine and hoping that it gets responses. You never know. Steve Martin said it best, the loneliest place in the world is in front of a mic and, you know, 1,000 people.
Yeah,
you're out there totally alone. And what I've learned from studying humor, it seems strange to say I'm studying humor, you know, I guess it's like being a sexologist. You're studying sex, and you're trying to be objective about it. Is there are no absolute rules for what's funny and what's not funny. And there is no absolute rules to explain why somebody finds a joke funny or not funny. Ask any comic who's been up there and has a golden routine that brought the house down the night before, and tonight the only thing he hears or she hears is the ice tinkling in the glass while people consume large amounts of alcohol to cope with this dearth of humor, right? There's no way to figure that out. And then it's compounded by the fact that humor is cultural. Humor is tied to language. Humor is tied to time-space. And humor is tied to the immediate moment. So we've already talked about Saturday Night Live. So we go all the way back. You're that old. I didn't realize you were that old. Thanks be to God, you're still alive. All right. I am Jewish and Italian, so I can get away with that. Anyway, so you're still alive. You know, you turn on Saturday Night Live this weekend, and you're going to sit there and go, what the devil are they making fun of? Well, because they're satirizing and parodying shows that you don't watch.
Right.
And the bands that come on, what? Who? They're, huh? And it's not Jim Belushi, you know, it's not Dan Aykroyd, it's not, you know, name the comic that you like, it's not Faye, it's gone, they're totally gone. It's not, you have, this is contemporaneous to the time. My undergraduates think it's hilarious. To me, it's watching Chinese acrobats. I have no idea what's going on.
Great point, Al, though, because I was, as you relayed a couple of Rodney Dangerfield jokes, and you know,
yeah.
I don't get no respect, you know. You know exactly what's coming next is a pretty short one-liner that often can be a groaner, but they still read well, at least to me, because I've been exposed to them before. You know, I told my mother I was going to run away. She said, on your mark.
Good set. Yeah, I know. I love those. But there's nobody doing Rodney Dangerfield now. Rodney Dangerfield had the, you know, he sold, he was the clown comic. Because the face, grabbing the tie. I'm doing it right now on the phone. Can you see it?
Yes.
You know, grabbing the tie, you know, breaking the neck, dropping the smile to one side. You know, I get no respect at all. I mean, home cooking to me meant eating out, whatever it was. He had this unending, and he did it, by the way. I saw him at his own club a couple times, not recently because he's dead, but, I mean, a number of years ago. And he just went from joke to joke, no break, no pause. Just he did it for an hour and 50 minutes and walked off stage.
Wow.
I mean, just I don't get no respect, boom. I don't get no respect, boom. And how he did it beyond comprehension. But you know, it took him 25 years to be an overnight success.
Oh, that's right, that's right. Before we go, Al, we only have about a minute left here. I do want to talk about...
Wait a minute, I've got all afternoon here. I'm not leaving.
Well, you're going to have to take a seat next to our music guy next. The Viktor Frankl. He survived the Nazi death camps. What did he say about the power of laughter?
Well, I think that's the really serious part of the book. And in there, I even give jokes of inmates who found themselves laughing. He says, without the spark of humor, I would have been so totally depressed I couldn't have gone on. That there was a promise of a life afterwards. And we didn't tell jokes. He said, did you hear the one about? But there were moments that you had to find levity in it. And the one that I really, you know, dwell on is, or point out is, the Nazi guard knocks down one of his colleagues and hits him and throws him to the ground. The guard looks over and says, Schwein! And the man looks up and says, Cohen, nice to meet you. You know, it was spitting in the face of evil. It was spitting in the face of death. And therefore, that was a moment of relief. I think humor, as Mel Brooks says, is a defense against the universe. And that we need humor in order not to die from the truth.
There's so much fun to be had in the book, and moments like we just had now where we realize that we really do need to have humor around us at all times. The book is called The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. Al Jeaney from Chicago wrote it. Al, I want to take one of your courses at Loyola sometime.
You're the best. Thank you so much. It's been a great fun.
All right, take care. And we will take a short break. When we come back, we will get Josh Gross into the chair, and we'll talk about five bands coming to the region for this month's edition of Rogue Sounds, coming up here on the Jefferson Exchange. Mm-hmm.